What's going on, everybody? It's your boy Jordan.
And this is Desmond.
And welcome to episode 235 of Two Black Nerds. Yeah. That's right. It's that time once again for us to bring you our opinions and hot takes on all things fandom, pop culture, and entertainment. As always, you can find Two Black Nerds wherever you get your podcasts. Please make sure to hit that subscribe button and leave us a friendly rating and comment to show your support. And of course, join in on the conversation each and every week by following us on all social media at Two Black Nerds. We appreciate that love, y'all. And let's not forget to mention we have merchandise that's available now at twoblacknerds.com. Go check out our Nerds of Mischief collection, inspired by Loki. We got t-shirts, crew neck city stickers, mugs, and tote bags. So go ahead and place those orders right now. On today's show, we'll be reviewing two new releases from director Guy Ritchie, the spy action comedy film, The Ministry of Unintentionally Warfare, and the Netflix series, The Gentleman. Also, we'll discuss the new Japanese anime film based on the manga and TV series, Spy Family, Code White. Plus, we'll share our thoughts on Amazon's live-action series based on the popular video game franchise, Fallout. But before we get to any and all of that, we're kicking off this week's podcast with our review of the new vampire horror film, Abigail.
You all came, highly recommended. You know the rules. No real names, no backstories, no cell phones.
So whose kid is she?
A very wealthy man who's about to be $50 million poorer.
I'm here to make sure you're safe.
What's your name? Mine's Abigail.
You can call me Joey.
Do you have any kids?
I have a little boy.
See you in 24 hours.
Do you know what a Pinky Promise is? If you behave and do as we say, like Pinky Promise you, it'll all be over soon.
Joey?
Yeah?
I'm sorry about what's gonna happen to you.
What the fuck?
We gotta get out of here.
I think she knows something.
Guys?
Guys? Guys!
Oh, no!
What the fuck is that thing?
We kidnapped a fucking vampire. A ballerina vampire. Okay. How do we kill a vampire? What are we talking about, like an Anne Rice or a True Blood? You know, Twilight? Stake through the heart.
Daylight is a big one.
All right, let's go kill us a fucking vampire. Ready?
Now, this movie is directed by Matt Bettinelli Open and Tyler Gillett, collectively known as Radio Silence. It's also written by Stephen Shields and Guy Busick, and it's starring a cast of Melissa Barrera, Dan Stevens, Catherine Newton, Will Catlett, Kevin Durant, Angus Cloud, Alicia Weir, and Giancarlo Esposito. So Matt Bettinelli and Tyler Open, this is now a hot new directing team that's been really, really successful in a short amount of time. A few years ago, they kind of had their claim to fame with the film Ready or Not, which put them on a lot of people's radars. And shortly thereafter that, they made two back-to-back Scream films, which were hugely successful, pretty much the most successful Scream films that have been made up until that point. But then they decided to step away after Scream 6 and sort of take on some other projects. And most recently, this one being Abigail, which is technically a remake slash reimagining of Dracula's Daughter, which is one of the original Universal monster horror films that came out in 1936. It was the direct sequel to the original Dracula movie with Bela Lugosi. But this movie is quite different, definitely a much, much different reimagining compared to that film. But ultimately, this directing duo has been really successful, and now they're taking on a variety of new projects. I know they have a lot of stuff coming down the pipeline even after this movie, but we got a chance to go check out this movie this past weekend and go check out and see what it was about. So with all of that out the way, man, I will pass it over to you. What did you think about this new vampire horror film, Abigail?
What a fun time in the theater. Abigail. This movie is so interesting because there's so many things about it to like. I don't think it necessarily does almost anything perfect, but it does a lot of things really, really well. That made it just such a fun watch and enjoyable experience. One of them being the cast. Melissa Barrera is becoming one of my favorite final girls. You know what I mean? She's really like one of those, I don't know, man. I don't know if necessarily Scream Queen yet is what I could call her, but it's just really cool to see her leading films like this, because she works for it and she makes sense, I think, of the grand scheme of a lot of these films. Alicia Ware, of course. I think I sang her praises on the podcast after talking about Matilda the musical. I thought that musical was tremendous. She's tremendous in this. It's funny because I'm betting like she's just a really good dancer as well. And Abigail is supposedly about, again, Dracula's daughter who does do ballet. So I think that might have carried over into this film as well. She probably didn't have to train too much. I think she might be just a good dancer and a good actress overall, because I really enjoyed Alicia Ware in this movie as well. Dan Stevens, I thought, in a lot of ways, kind of started to steal the show. You know what I mean? He had some really, really good and cool moments. I was like, man, are we sure this isn't his movie? This feels like it might be Dan Stevens' movie. So I absolutely enjoyed him as well. And then I have to give a shout out to Angus Cloud. Rest in peace. They do a good job of kind of sending him off. You know, it was one of his last posthumous releases that he has after his death. And what's so interesting is when you're watching the film, Angus Cloud is a part of it, but there's a couple moments that felt like they might have been, I don't know if blooper is the word, but like some footage they weren't going to use before, but after he passed, like they might have decided to keep some of that footage in to make sure he had more screen time. I think I could feel that in the movie too. I'm like, huh, I don't know if that would have been in the movie, but because yeah, it made sense in that way. William Catlett, great. Catherine Newton, last shout out, because she's collecting Infinity Stones at this point. I mean, she's Dracula, slasher movies, Frankenstein. Like, this girl, she will do anything. And I really like that about her. She's also like becoming one of those cool low-key scream queens that we have today. So I really love that she was in this movie doing something different. I appreciate that. Also, Giancarlo, enough said. People know, we know how we feel about Giancarlo. Amazing. But this movie, man, again, it follows a group of criminals. They kidnap a 12-year-old girl, turns out to be a vampire. The thing I thought they would spend a little more time on in this film, they're trapped in a house with a vampire, right? But they do this work for you to understand that everybody that's trapped in the house with her has a specialty. And then they don't really do anything with the specialties. That's one thing that was like, huh, I thought we were going to do something with those. And they never really do. It just turns into like the thriller, horror, normal horror film without those specialties. I was hoping they would do a little bit of that, but they really don't. Another thing, the last act, it's fun, but it also kind of just like falls off the hinges. I was like, I don't know how we got here, but here we are now with this again. It's a great time, but also like it did take away from, I think, from the story of the movie a little bit. But overall, Abigail is a great time. Again, Alicia Ware, it does a really good job of playing, the vampire. It's gritty. It's dark. I love the tension that they create. There's a couple moments where you can't necessarily see everything that's happening, but you just kind of hear it. And then you see the repercussion. And I think that's terrifying. Like, I think that's, they did some really, a really good job there with a lot of, those effects and things like that, man. But man, this film was really fun for me. I can't wait to see what they do next. They really haven't missed for me yet. Matt Bettinelli and Tyler Gillett, they really haven't missed for me yet. I like Ready or Not. I like the Scream movies. And I like Abigail. So I'm pretty on board with them as directors. I think they have a lot to say. I think they have a cool style to them, and a lot to do, man. But this was just one of those films, I think, that I wish was on a, not that more people knew about, because I think if this, whenever this comes on streaming, it's going to go crazy. I really do. I think it's going to do a really good job. So I hope more people continue to go see it in theaters and the box office. But there's a lot going on right now, and I understand. But man, I really enjoyed Abigail for what it was.
So Abigail is a movie for me that it continued to evolve over the course of its runtime, which is probably the aspect that I enjoyed the most about it, that it never stayed one type of movie for the duration of the film. You know, it begins as a more traditional crime thriller, kind of a hostage movie about that group kidnapping this 12-year-old girl, but then it eventually becomes this slaughterhouse killer movie about a dancing ballerina who's a vampire. It's crazy. I didn't have that on my bingo card for movies in 2024 about a killer ballerina vampire, but here we are, and I think it's a great addition to this crazy and creepy little girls canon of horror films that we're getting lately. You know, films like Orphan and Megan, pretty much any exorcism movie you can place this alongside, and now this. It's a really great addition, and that's because you get these really, really wonderful performances from the entire cast. Everybody has really good chemistry with each other. They're not huge names. These are faces that you'll probably recognize, but they're not movie stars per se, but everybody works together so well, and they execute upon their roles so well. And I definitely have to call out Alicia Ware, who holds her own completely against this group of adults, essentially, that she's acting against, because her as the villain, she just commands the screen in such a way. There's a giddiness to her performance, but also this sadistic nature to her. But there's also an element where it's like, I'm kind of rooting for her. I want her to be the one who's like the last one standing in all of this. It changes and morphs over time, and she has to do so much and convey so many emotions. I thought she was absolutely amazing. I think Melissa Barrera, she's just a relatable girl, a relatable woman who just feels like somebody you would know and feels like somebody who you could speak to and can have a conversation with. But also there's this dark past and history to her characters in both this movie and also in the Scream movies that we see. But these dark pasts make her really formidable. They make her a worthwhile opponent to whatever threat is out there at play. Everybody else does a really, really tremendous job. I think Kevin Durant was extremely funny in this movie. He's kind of the heavy, the big muscular guy, the big bodybuilder guy, but he's just absolutely hilarious with everything that he delivers. And overall, I think that the physicality as well in this movie is something to point out. It's a really, really physical movie. There's a lot of physically commanding performances, physical comedy, but also physical horror and physical violence. A lot of that really created and brought to life by Alicia Ware. And then there's stomach churning violence. There's buckets and buckets of blood and gore and guts all over the place. It becomes quite cartoonish, but it still remains fun. It still has that fun element to it. And I think that it's great when you can just go into a movie that you know is going to be over the top in a certain respect, but still you can have a great time with it. And ultimately, this is another great addition for this directing pair. And really, their entire production company, Radio Silence, also their writing partners, they didn't write this movie, but they work with them quite frequently. They've already assembled a really, really impressive resume of films, and they've kind of taken over the horror genre in a lot of respects. You know, I think with those two Scream films, Ready or Not and now this, they have carte blanche to kind of do whatever they want. They really are. They have like three projects lined up. They're making a sequel to Escape from New York, which is one of my favorite movies.
It's crazy.
And now I'm actually excited about that. Like initially I would be kind of concerned, but seeing what they did with this reimagining of a well-known property, you know, coming from Dracula's Daughter and just reinventing it and making it essentially a complete original film, I thought was great, because that original movie, there's not a dancing ballerina that's a vampire. But it is interesting because Dracula's Daughter, she is kind of musical. She can play the piano in that movie, but she's not a ballerina by any stretch, not a dancer by any stretch of the imagination. So I just love what they did with her in this movie. And so, I think in all likelihood, this is probably one of the more fun and campy vampire movies that you'll see, but that's a genre and a type of film that I think needs this. I think oftentimes we see Dracula and vampire films, which they can become a little self-serious. They can be very bogged down by their mythology and just the serious heavy nature of them. This one's just like, no, toss all of that out the way, have fun with it, watch bodies fly and hit the floor and buckets of blood just fly everywhere, just have a great time with it, don't really think about it all that much. I do want to ask you one thing though, because this movie in the marketing reveals that this is a vampire. This little girl is a vampire. And as I was watching the movie, the way that it's framed and constructed makes it appear as if this was supposed to be a surprise reveal in the middle of the story. Mm. Not that we just automatically come into it assuming and knowing that that was the case. I think that the way it's all constructed, because the main characters have no clue, and they leave breadcrumbs to lead us to that path. And I wonder just along the way if maybe Universal and the producers, they decided like, hey, you know, if we really want people to come and see this, we got to reveal our biggest hand. We got to show that this is a vampire, essentially, and that this is Dracula's daughter. We can't hide that aspect. And I don't know if that was necessarily the best choice. Maybe it was because it did pretty well at the box office. But a part of me also kind of wishes that this was like a big, huge reveal in the movie. Like if we were just watching it and we were wondering, like, what is this kidnap thriller about? And then we see she's actually a killer vampire ballerina dancer. That would have been like a crazy reveal to experience in the theater. So what did you think about just that, you know, and possibly some of the choices that might have been made, I think, to make us as an audience sort of aware of that? And did that take away at all from the film for you?
Yeah, you know what's so interesting that you say that is watching the movie, I sat there and I was like, it's taken us kind of a while to get to the reveal. You know what I mean? Like, of knowing, again, this is all in the marketing. We know exactly who the vampire is. And so I was like, huh, I wonder when they're going to reveal this. Like, it literally took like 30 minutes, 35 minutes or something crazy for them to actually reveal that she was a vampire. And so, man, that's so interesting that you say that, because part of me thinks, I don't know how else you technically get the butts in seats if you don't say that either. You know what I mean? Like, I don't know if people just would have went for a trailer where it's like, oh, there's a vampire in the building, but I don't know. But it's not the ballerina little girl. Like, I don't know. I really don't know. I think that's a hard thing to kind of think about for me, because I agree, I would have rather have just had it be a big reveal, you know what I mean? Even though, again, watching the movie, you're like, oh, it's gotta be her. And I was even saying that knowing it was her. I was like, oh man, they have to know it's her. So I think there is some things there that's kind of parallels, like knowing that it's her also kind of helps. But at the same time, I would have loved that reveal if done correctly, if done right. Maybe they would have taken a little more time out to get to that reveal, you know what I mean? Maybe, I don't know what they would have done, but I am very curious as well if the marketing was different, how the marketing could have been different to get people in the theater, but also maintain that reveal. I don't know what they could have done, but I think it would have been a welcome change.
Yeah, it's tricky. You know, I think I don't know this, but it felt like that they conceived this to be a surprise, that they conceived this movie to shoehorn this well-known character, this iconic character into this film without giving it away entirely. And perhaps that was the intention from the get-go, but then once they had the finished movie and it was time to start up the marketing campaign, they probably sat down and said, like, look, there's really not a way to market this movie without giving it away. There's just not enough there, or there's not a creative or ingenious idea that we have that can actually get people excited to come and see this, because I don't think that a kidnapping movie about this little girl who's a ballerina is necessarily going to do it. That's just not enough. You know, exactly. You got to really have the hook there. Mm-hmm. And maybe there was a way to showcase that she is a vampire ballerina, but how do you hide the Dracula stuff? How do you maybe hold that back and maybe not give that away, that she's the son of the most famous vampire in literature and mythology that we've ever known, right? And so maybe there was a way to get there, but I'm not sure. I mean, ultimately, it doesn't necessarily take away from my enjoyment, but I did think about that, and I agree. It did take a while to get to that place where it's like, oh yeah, now we just can let loose and have fun with it. You know, we don't have to, you know, be bogged down in the details and the mystery of it. But be that as it may, it's still a really, really good film, still a super enjoyable film, whether you know what to expect or not. And I can't wait to see what these two do next with their next few projects. But folks, those are all of our thoughts on the brand new film, Abigail. If you've checked us out, definitely hit us up and let us know what you think. And with that being said, we're going to transition to our next film, a new film from director Guy Ritchie, The Ministry of Ungentlemanly Warfare.
Gus March Phillips, I have a mission I want you to lead. Thank you, Sergeant.
What's the plan?
To neutralize the German U-boats in the North Atlantic.
We're losing the war.
Hitler is not playing by the rules, so neither are we.
We both know that I'm not very popular with the administration.
The reason they find you unattractive is the very reason I find you attractive.
If I'm to do this, I'll need my own team. You won't like them. They're all...
No!
Mad.
They'll need to be.
This is an unsanctioned, unauthorized mission. If we fail, England will be condemned to a lifetime under the German boot.
And so I said, that is not a dog. That is my wife!
It's very good.
Operation are reckless.
Abort this mission now.
Hello, can't hear you.
Please do off.
Now, as I mentioned, this movie is directed by Guy Ritchie. It's written by Paul Tomasi, Eric Johnson, Arash Emel, and Guy Ritchie. And it's starring Henry Cavill, Isaac Gonzalez, Alan Richten, Alex Pettifer, Hero Fine Tiffin, and many, many others are part of this cast as well. So The Ministry of Ungentlemanly Warfare is a movie I wanted to go check out this past week, which, by the way, Guy Ritchie has just been on a ridiculous streak of movie making for the past few years. He is putting out a lot of projects. Yeah. Like every single year he has something coming out, and I'm going to talk about something very briefly after this as well, a TV series that he also has on Netflix. But this movie was interesting to me because of the cast. Really, I wanted to see Henry Cavill and Alan Richten and Isaac Gonzalez. Didn't know much about the story, but turns out that this is a film that's based on a true story about a series of declassified files from Winston Churchill from World War II, in which he formed this combat secret organization for Britain's military, ultimately with the goal of raiding a Italian and German ship in West Africa, and to get them to sail that ship to Lagos. He wanted to get this ship out of Nazi occupation, ultimately. And so this is set firmly in World War II. It's definitely about a group of British soldiers essentially going against Nazis. And this group is comprised of a motley crew of rogues and mavericks, and their methods are considered unconventional or ungentlemanly, to say the least. That's really kind of the purpose of the title. But also a part of this committee who formed this group alongside Winston Churchill was Ian Fleming. And if you know the name of Ian Fleming, Ian Fleming is the creator of James Bond. And so this is all based on factual stuff that happened. And these declassified files only came out a few years ago. They were hidden, I think, for decades and decades. And I believe it might have been 2018 or 2019. Probably somebody in the comments can fact check that. But they just recently came out to reveal this story. And it's super interesting. And it's basically about a bunch of guys who take a tremendous amount of pleasure in killing Nazis. That's really what this movie is about. And I felt like it was a mix of Inglourious Bastards, but then also Sisu, which came out last year.
Yeah, I knew you was going to say that, yeah.
Where it's just like, we get to see a guy just murder Nazis, and we can also have fun with it. It doesn't have to be bogged down in the dark, serious nature, obviously, of World War II, of Nazi-occupied Germany, and just all of the horror and the conflict and what they did to Jewish people during that time and during the Holocaust and World War II. This is just meant to be a carefree, fun adventure. And ultimately, I had a lot of fun with it. You know, Guy Ritchie, as of late, can be somewhat hit or miss. You know, he came out with the movie last year, Operation Fortune. Wasn't a big fan of that. But then the year prior, he had Wrath of Man with Jason Statham. Really, really liked that movie. Mm-hmm. He's been very, very hit or miss for me. But when he hits, he absolutely hits, because this movie is just so much fun. The cast is great. Henry Cavill is having a great, great time in this film. It looks like he's just having a ton of fun. Alan Richten, man, I love him. He's in Reacher. And basically, they take the best parts about him in Reacher and they bring it over to this movie. He is amazing at killing. He's just an unstoppable killing machine. And his knife play in this movie, he primarily uses a knife to kill Nazis. It's unbelievable. The kills that he's responsible for in this movie, this is also kind of cartoonish and over the top, but it's unbelievable. It's so fun to just see him let loose. Like, he's such a physical presence in everything that he does. Isaac Gonzalez is also really good. I love how she's able to stand out pretty much in every role that she does. She becomes kind of the heart of most movies. Because the one thing I would say that could be, I guess, a criticism of this movie is that you don't get a ton of backstory or characterization mm-hmm. with these people. Like, there's not a lot to learn. And that's okay. Like, I don't need to necessarily know a lot about them. But if you want to be critical of it, you can say that you don't really get the depth of these characters. They're not fully fleshed out. She's the one character that you get to learn a little bit more about. And they also put her in certain precarious positions that make you care about her. Everybody else is just so good at their job. They're not really ever... It doesn't ever feel like that they're threatened. It doesn't necessarily mm-hmm. feel like that they're going to lose their life. But she's put in positions that I think are very smartly and intelligently done to get us to care about her and to make us want to make sure that she's going to be okay on the other side of this. And so that's the one criticism about the characters. But be that as it may, this is just a really fun film, again, about, you know, something that could be considered dark and very serious in tone. But Guy Ritchie, he just knows how to infuse certain stories with his brand of comedy and his brand of violence. And I thought that everything here, from a tonal standpoint, from an action standpoint, from just a gratuitous violence standpoint, to just, you know, let yourself let go and have fun with this, it was really, really good. There's some really good action, some excellent kills, a lot of fun chemistry between the ensemble cast of characters. Henry Golding is also in this. He's really good as well. Overall, just had a really good time with it. And Guy Ritchie, when he's operating in this mode, when he's focused and he just takes something and has fun with it, that's when I like him best. And I think that he's, you know, he's sort of reached a new area of his career that I'm interested to continue to see evolve and develop, because, you know, he has such high highs in the beginning with Lock, Stop and Two Smoking Barrels and Snatch. Like, those were such great movies. Mm-hmm. Now he's obviously morphed into a different type of filmmaker, and after what he did in 2019, making Aladdin and making that a billion-dollar movie, he can kind of do whatever he wants, and you can tell that he's just kind of doing whatever he wants. But I love when he can just, you know, stick with his brand of comedy and action and violence and really excel and make it as great as it can be. So had a lot of fun with this. It exceeded all my expectations, and definitely can't wait to watch it again in the future.
Man, this dude Guy Ritchie been working. I'm glad to hear this movie worked out, though. Man, it sounds like he finally, I don't know if finally got it together is the right words, but like you said, it's kind of been up and down these past couple years. I actually got some Guy Ritchie catch up to do. I haven't seen him like you have, but man, I'm really glad to hear about this one, because even hearing about, I really like the title because it's so extra. Like, the Ministry of Ungentlemanly Warfare is such a long title. Like, that is a mouthful of a title, but it reminds me of like the League of Extraordinary Gentlemen and, like, you know what I mean, like things like that. So I can't wait to check it out, man. I love the action, I love that cast. I'm gonna watch it soon.
Yes, it's very over the top for sure. He knows how to really lean into that. I'll just quickly also point out another one of his projects. It's crazy that he has a movie in theaters and he also has this TV series on Netflix, but on Netflix he just released a series called The Gentlemen, which is actually a spinoff from a movie that he made in 2019, also called The Gentleman. One of his better efforts in recent years. I like that movie, and it has an incredible cast, Matthew McConaughey and Colin Farrell. Really, really solid movie. And so the fact that he was going to continue in this world on Netflix in a series format, wanted to check that out as well. And I got a chance to check out all 8 episodes of The Gentleman. And it's good. It's overall, it's really solid. I don't know if I can say it's better than the movie per se. Probably not, just because you don't have that heavy hitting star power in this series like you do in the movie. But Theo James and Kayla Scodelario, I think is how you pronounce her name, they're the two leads of this movie. They both are really good. They have a lot of chemistry with each other. We primarily follow their relationship. Essentially, it's ultimately about Theo James's character. He inherits this vastly wealthy empire, but it turns out that this empire is very much embroiled in a criminal enterprise and underworld. They're involved in drugs, and so he now has to deal with all these colorful characters that come with this crazy criminal empire that he was not anticipating, but now he has to adapt his life to. And it's really just about that. And that's also very similar to the movie. It's about a person inheriting something, and now it's all of a sudden them involved in criminal, you know, doings. And ultimately, this is more, I think, traditional Guy Ritchie, where you kind of get the hallmarks of what his movies are about. It's about gangsters and drugs and foul language and stylish fashion and over the top violence, because this is ultimately about an aristocratic family and how they operate in the drug world and how they operate in the criminal world, which is, you know, it's kind of a juxtaposition of those ideas. Like, they're British aristocrats, they're high class, very affluent, very wealthy, but they're moving like gangsters, you know. So it's not like Scorsese gangsters, you know. It's not like gangsters that that have to come from behind. They're underdogs and they have to build their empires. Like, no, these people are very, very wealthy already, and they're doing this for whatever reason, to get more money, to get more power, to get more influence. Maybe just because they're bored. But be that as it may, this show was pretty solid, and I think it actually got better as it went along. The first couple of episodes, I'm like, the pacing could be a little bit better. I don't know if it needed to be as drawn out as it was, but by the last four or so episodes, where it really gets into the nitty gritty of the details and the story, and you kind of see some of the characters start to change and evolve, particularly Theo James's character, and the stakes just ultimately get raised, that's when it becomes good. And there are some other, you know, really good people a part of this. Ray Winstone is in this show. He's fun. He's just having the time of his life. He's obviously a frequent collaborator of Guy Ritchie. Giancarlo Esposito is also in the show, and he was in Abigail. He's working.
He's in everything.
And we know why he's working. He just had that incredible quote come out about, you know, his life and where he was before Breaking Bad. And so I love that he's working so frequently here. He's not in the show a ton, but when he pops up, love to see him always and anytime. And ultimately, I had a decent time with it. I think it's a good companion piece alongside the movie. If you like the movie, if you were a fan of that, I think you'll find enough out of this that you'll be a fan of as well. And so we'll see if it gets a season two or not. I know it was definitely a successful show in terms of viewership and watch time and all those things. I don't think that they've confirmed season two just yet, but I'd be interested to continue down this journey if they do so.
I feel like that's all they care about. It's the viewership anyway.
Watch time, minutes.
The show could suck. But as long as they watched it, you know what I'm saying? It's on the radar for a new season. But yeah, I'm gonna have like a whole Guy Ritchie stretch of where I'm just like, let me catch up on the movies I haven't seen. Let me watch The Gentlemen and get my life together. I'm gonna get it together. But yeah, I can't wait to watch this either.
No doubt. But folks, those are all of our thoughts on The Ministry of Ungentlemanly Warfare and The Gentlemen on Netflix. If you've checked out either this movie or the series, definitely hit us up and let us know what you think. And with that being said, we're going to transition and talk about our next film, a film that Dez actually got to check out this past weekend, a new film based on the Japanese manga and television series Spy Family Code White.
I'll see you in hell, baby. Would have gotten them all if they weren't so fast.
They're not moving, Anya.
For their first family vacation, the Forgers travel to the snow-covered land of Phrygis.
Careful wandering off. We don't want you getting lost.
It's a special night, so I think it's okay for Anya to stay up past her bedtime.
That trip?
You must retrieve the microfilm without fail.
Ended up holding the fate of the world.
This will lead to war between East and West.
What a nosy little girl. Kill her!
Don't tell me Anya's gotten herself mixed up with the military.
Fire! War's coming anyway!
No matter what, we can't give up now! If that microfilm ends up in the wrong hands, it could alter the fate of the world.
Uh-oh! I'm in big trouble!
Let's do this as a family.
Is that all you've got? Eliminate them.
He's 10. I'm gonna save them.
Wait for me, Anya.
Spy Family. Code White.
I'll get them back. Whatever it takes.
Now, this film is directed by Takashi Katagiri and it's written by Ichiro Okuchi, and it's starring a cast of voice actors. I'm not going to try to pronounce their names because I would ultimately butcher them. I'm just going to spare myself of that. But again, as I mentioned before the trailer, Spy Family Code White, it is based off of a manga and TV series that I think has been running for, what, 5 or 6 years now? It's a pretty recent manga, if I'm not mistaken.
Because the anime has only been like 2 years.
Only a couple of years. Sounds about right. Right. Mm-hmm. So this is a pretty recent anime and manga series that's come out, and they decided to go ahead and release a theatrical film this past weekend. They released alongside Abigail and Ministry of Ungentlemanly Warfare, so it was a busy weekend at the movies, but you got a chance to go check this out, and so I know you definitely dove into this particular property. So what did you think about this new film, Spy Family Code White?
So Spy Family is such a fun anime, before I talk about the movie already, because It's one of the ones that feel a little less serious. It pulls from all the spy things that you love, I'd say. 007. They actually do a in homage to Mission Impossible in the movie. It was really cool if you see the movie. It was really small, but it was like, oh shoot, that's definitely Mission Impossible. And then the premise itself is very Mr. and Mrs. Smith. So what's cool about Spy Family is, I'm gonna give you the small premise. The dad is a spy agent. In order to get his to do his assignment, he has to adopt a child. He adopts a daughter. The daughter is, she's a telepath. She can read minds. But he never knows. She never tells him that she's a telepath. She's like 6 years old. Also, in order to get the daughter into school appropriately, which is part of his mission, he has to have a wife. He finds this random chick who needs a husband short term or just really fast. And they end up in this like somewhat really fast, quick marriage with no barriers, right? No borders, no boundaries. Turns out she's an assassin.
Of course. Of course.
And so the spy and the assassin have no idea that what they do. They think he's a psychiatrist and she's like, I don't know what she's supposed to be doing. But the only person that knows everything is the telepathic daughter, and nobody knows the daughter's telepathic. It's ridiculous. Wow. It's so crazy. But this movie pretty much follows the mission has to take place out of town. Like the dad is trying to get the daughter to pass her cooking class for a very important mission, so they have to go overseas, in which it goes down over there. Like it of course, like the stakes get super high, the world's at risk all of a sudden. Again, it's just crazy. And it's a fun time. This is, again, one of the few anime movies I've watched recently that has just so much levity to it. It's so fun to watch it. You're just kind of living in the moment versus like you're not watching a My Hero movie or Dragon Ball movie or like where you know you have to know a lot of knowledge prior to going into that film. Either that or it's not bogged down by how high the stakes are per se. Even though I just say the stakes were high, it's like they're very unserious in this anime. And so it's a really fun watch. Anya, the little girl, remains like one of the cutest anime characters we've gotten in years. She's adorable. That's really it, man. It's a fun, cute anime movie. It's very family oriented, but again, you get really cool action. The dad's a spy, the mom's an assassin, the little girl's a telepath. It's not like you're absent of any of those fun things either. So really fun time in the movies. Not perfect, just because it's long. It's like an hour 50. I was like, damn, we've been in here a long time. So it's not necessarily the perfect pacing, but when it's good, it's good. So yeah, man, I was very happy to check this out. It provided a good energy to the weekend.
Yeah, I think you know, a lot of spy films or TV shows, they tend to be more serious because we're dealing with world threatening issues and secret covert organizations, like real dark shit. I mean, even as fun as like the Mission Impossible movies can be, the consequences of what could go down are pretty dire. It's like,
it's pretty crazy.
If this happens, shit is going to go left very, very quickly. And so it's actually nice to hear that this one is just like really light on its feet. There's a lot of levity to it. Of course, yes, the stakes have to be high, especially for that central family, because there's all these secrets amongst them. But we can just have fun with it and play with that and play with the secrecy and the mystery behind that. And to center it on a young girl, too, for the most part, like having her as like the central figurehead. Kind of brilliant decision, because she has more knowledge and information than everybody else, like even more than the adults have, you know, and that creates a whole different dichotomy and a whole different dynamic between everybody. So that sounds really cool. I'm actually interested to check this one out and see more about it. To your knowledge, though, is this based off of a particular run in the manga? Like, are they directly lifting from a story that's already been told, or is this more of an original story that they tried to tell?
To be honest, I don't know. Part of me thinks they just made it up. Like just the way it's kind of written and the way it goes, because it feels just like a extra adventure that's tacked onto the anime. Okay. Like it doesn't feel like it necessarily has to be part of anything. So part of me believes they just wanted to make a movie and made a story up. So yeah, part of me wants to say no, it's not attached to the manga.
Better than what just happened with what was that, Jujutsu Kaisen, that pretty much put together some episodes as a preview and put it in a movie theater and said like, hey, you know, this is gonna come out in a few months, just go check out the episodes. But we've already seen
Demon Slayer.
Got that mixed up. But it's good to see that they just decided to, you know, go in a different direction and do something original and different, mm-hmm. and make it its own story. But folks, those are all of our thoughts on the brand new anime films, Spy Family, Code White. If you got a chance to check this out, definitely hit us up and let us know what you think. And with our final review this week, we're going to talk about the live action adaptation of the popular video game franchise that just premiered on Prime Video, Fallout.
I know that I've lived a relatively comfortable life.
Stop! Mercy!
You need to go home. Vault dwellers are an endangered species. I do not think you would be willing to do what it takes to survive up here.
If you insist on staying, then you will have to adapt.
So they say will be a lovely day. A bright new sun will suddenly break through. But I don't want to see tomorrow unless I see it with you.
I grabbed a moldy one.
Now, this series is created by Graham Wagner and Geneva Robertson Dwart, and it's based on the Fallout video game series by Bethesda, and it's starring Ella Purnell, Aaron Moten, Kylan MacLachlan, Moses Arias, Zyla Mendes-Jones, excuse me if I mispronounced that, and Walton Goggins as well rounds out the cast. And so Fallout has been in the video game consciousness, has been a popular franchise, I think, for like 26 or 27 years now, a really long time. Mm-hmm. A lot of games in the series. And recently, the past couple of years, Amazon decided to purchase the rights to do a live action adaptation of the video game franchise. But in fact, what's interesting about Fallout is that this series is an original story. It's technically not based mm-hmm. on any of the video game storylines that have come before it. They wanted to tell a completely original story. And then also I found out that the creators of the video game franchise wanted to make sure that if they were going to do this series, that they did not include anything in the series that would potentially give away future storylines for the next Fallout game, which I believe is going to be Fallout 5 that's mm-hmm. going to come out. So this is going in a completely different direction, but obviously still having a lot of connective tissue to the video games, a lot of Easter eggs and a lot of things that call back to that franchise. I got a chance to check out all of the series. I know you checked out a few episodes as well. Mm-hmm. I could just dive in and give my thoughts really quickly and say that as a person who has not played any of the Fallout video games, I am complete novice. I don't know anything about this world or this universe. The only thing I really I've seen is a couple of trailers over the years. I've always just like watched the trailers because they've been really, really great at putting together trailers and getting you excited about the story and what it was going to entail. I just never actually played any of the games, but I wanted to check out this series just because of the era that we're now in. We're seeing a lot of video game properties being adapted into TV and movies, and they're becoming more successful. They're actually becoming worth our time to watch. And so I was excited about this one, and I got to say that this is a really, really good show that surprised me quite a bit because I wasn't anticipating how much I would enjoy it. And by the end of those 8 episodes, I walked away thinking like, wow, I am a fan of the series, and I also want to know a lot more about this universe and about this world that they've built with Fallout. And I started to do deeper dives on YouTube videos to find out more about the mythology and the lore of Fallout. And there's a ton of stuff out there because they have been doing this for such a long time. But I just really, really enjoyed the show for what it was. This story in particular actually begins 219 years after the nuclear war of 2077, which pretty much decimates the entire United States, and it forces the citizens of the United States to take up shelter in various vaults that are created by this company called Vault Tech. It's essentially supposed to shelter them from nuclear war, but turns out this company Vault Tech isn't just creating these vaults to shelter people. They're also doing some pretty sinister shit behind the scenes. They're experimenting on people. They're doing a lot of crazy stuff, a lot of just weird experimentation on people. Turns out you can't trust big corporations. Who knew? but ultimately, that's what a lot of the story is about. But this particular show focuses on three characters, and those are the characters played by Ella Purnell, Aaron Morden, and Walton Goggins. It's really about those three and follows those three. And I love individually all of their stories and how they ultimately intertwined. I think that the work that each individual character did to really get you to care about them and their backstory and the differences amongst them was just really, really well done. Ella Purnell, she is carrying a sense of optimism and purpose in her particular story. She's in search for her father. Aaron Morden is a part of one of the factions that exist in the Wasteland. The Wasteland is pretty much everything outside of the vaults, you know, and there's these various factions that come around. And the factions essentially kind of go to war with one another. It becomes a power struggle. It's a very dog-eat-dog world in this post-apocalyptic society. And you kind of see all of the changes that he undergoes and his transition as a character. And then Walton Goggins is directly affected by the nuclear war because he essentially becomes very deformed and becomes the ghoul, which is the primary antagonist of this first season. And so we're following this story from all different angles, and everybody is so different. But I just love the world building that they do with this series to get you up to speed. If you didn't know about Fallout, they do a really great job at incorporating a lot of different information and callbacks to certain things. And they just do a wonderful job at getting you acclimated to what this is all about and what's happening. And then with the individual stories, they're actually emotional, you know, and I think that's one of the things that kind of separates it from a lot of other adaptations of video game properties, where it's like, yeah, this starts off as one thing, but it actually becomes a really, really compelling sci-fi drama. You know, at the end of the day, I think that's ultimately what it's about. But it does genre bend. It does do a lot of things. At times it's satirical. At times there's a lot of black comedy. It is about nuclear war. All these different things are at play. And it not only embraces, I think, that lore and the mythology of what the video games establish, but it still manages to create something entirely new and entirely different on its own, that it can stand on its own 2 feet. And you don't have to have experienced or played the video games to come in and enjoy this. You can really just come at it as a newbie, for lack of a better term, and just watch it and be, I think, really, really, really swept up in the story and what they can do. And so by the end of it, which, you know, the finale was terrific and a great finale, it got me super excited about the future and sort of the directions that they point to in the future. Even that last episode, there's a direct reference to apparently one of the more popular video games and where they might go in the future. And that stuff gets me really excited, even though I haven't played that. But ultimately, this is a home run, I think, for Prime Video. This is a home run for video game adaptations, as we've seen lately. This is, you know, following in the footsteps of The Last of Us, which was hugely successful. And it also gets me very excited about Prime Video taking over God of War, because we know that they have purchased the rights to make a live action adaptation of that video game. And that is a game I have played countless hours, you know, of, and I've dedicated many, many years to the God of War franchise. And so I have a lot more faith now, seeing what they did with Fallout, seeing that they could take this property that is so beloved, it is so popular, and make it into something totally new and still get people to buy in and to support it. So I really, really enjoyed the show.
Yeah, it Fallout is so interesting for me because this is like one of the few video game TV shows slash movies that I've actually never got my hands on the game itself. Almost everything else we talk about or that's available right now, I've either beat or have like a lot of time in. So coming in watching Fallout, I agree. They do a really good job of getting you into the world and you learning about the world. I kind of knew about the world before, but I think it was cool to reiterate what it looked like and just the way that it felt. But I also have to echo, man, I think these actors are killing it. Ella Purnell, Aaron Moulton, and Walton Goggins. Also, Walton Goggins is a nerd, bro. He was just in I'm a Virgo. He was just like this dude. What else was he in? He was just in something else. He's Cecil. He's Cecil, Invincible.
Like, oh, that's right. Yeah.
He's a nerd. Walton Goggins is a nerd. But they're having a really good time. And I love how all different three of those characters are that you were just talking about. I mean, Walton Goggins is like cowboy Red Skull. Crazy. Ella Purnell was just like you said. I love her. They're all very clearly products of their environments. I think that's really cool because Ella Purnell, anywhere she pulls up in the show, you're like, why is she so happy? Like, you don't see these people over here. And I just love how the interactions she have with other characters of like, girl, if you don't go home, like, you're not supposed to be here. But I just really like what they're doing with the characters. And I think in terms of like, I think Aaron Moulton is acting. Like, I've seen some things from him. I'm like, this dude is going crazy. Do we see this? Are we paying attention to how well he's doing on screen? He's really killing it. But yeah, this Fallout series, again, I haven't finished it yet. Don't worry, I'm about too soon. Like, I already know how I feel after the first couple episodes of watching. I'm like, dang, yeah, I really like this. But it's so interesting that this is the one product or one video game thing I've never been able to get into. And it's making me more excited to potentially even go back and maybe play Fallout 4 or New Vegas or maybe or 76 or something like that. It really is. But what's also interesting, I've actually heard from people who've played the game that this show is doing even better than some of the source material, which is not the first time we've heard that. Again, Prime Video kind of did the same thing with The Boys. The Boys, I heard that a lot, that a lot of The Boys is better than the source material. So as of right now, Amazon, as of right now, is like, they're the kings of the video game shit. I'm sorry. They're kind of killing it. We'll see what happens. There's a lot more to come down the line. I get it. Last of Us is on HBO. I get it. But in terms of the nerd shit and some video game shit, Amazon is kind of the place to be right now, and that's where the nerds need to live at.
Yeah, I mean, collectively, all the geek stuff, the nerd stuff, the geek stuff, touch, it's really, really good. They are definitely giving the appropriate amount of time and resources to this stuff, and they're bringing on creators that are good too, because Jonathan Nolan is behind this series, and he's coming off of Westworld, you know, and I think he got tremendous experience on that show, out a world, building out a universe, coming over to this, you know, this particular property. And he does a fantastic job. He directs the first three episodes, which really, you know, sort of set the tone in a great way. And so I think that they're hiring the right people that if they're not at least fans of the material, they at least have an appetite to want to dive in and to do something different and original and unique. Like, even with The Boys and Invincible, we're seeing deviations. We're seeing stuff that's done somewhat differently, especially in the case of The Boys, where it's not just one for one adaptation. It's like, yeah, we'll adapt a lot of it, but we do have our own spin on this, and we have to consider the changing times. There's just so much to take into consideration when making these things. And so, yeah, I'm incredibly excited about what Prime Video is doing and what they will have coming down the pipeline with God of War, because that's going to be massive. That is going to be such a big one.
You're not going to be able to tell me nothing.
Oh, my God. That's going to have so much fanfare and anticipation around it. So they definitely got to hit that one out the park, and hopefully they certainly will. But, folks, those are all of our thoughts on the new Prime Video series Fallout. If you've checked us out on Amazon, definitely hit us up and let us know what you think. And with that being said, we have a few news items that we got to get to. In particular, we got to talk about three of our most celebrated and accomplished directors. There's some big news swirling around. Quentin Tarantino, Martin Scorsese, and Steven Spielberg, all heavy hitters in their own right. We've talked a lot about a variety of these directors, most notably Martin Scorsese and Steven Spielberg. We've reviewed several of their movies over the years. Quentin Tarantino, though, we have not reviewed any of his movies because his previous movie, Once Upon a Time in Hollywood, came out before we started this podcast. And all throughout these past few years, we have long wondered and awaited what is to be his final feature film, which he has been calling this shot I think, for about 12 years now. Back in 2012, he had first announced that he was only going to make 10 films. And so he made The Hateful Eight, and then he made Once Upon a Time in Hollywood, and now we're basically at 10. And over the past year or so, we've heard a lot of rumors about what this 10th movie was going to be. We even got a working title. The Movie Critic, apparently, is what it was going to be called. And we even found out from Tarantino himself that the premise of the film was going to be set in 1977, and it was going to be about the small-time movie critic who wrote reviews for porn magazines, which is somebody that he actually followed in his youth. So he was adapting somebody that he actually followed as a critic and was going to turn this into a story. And now he's not doing this movie anymore. The Movie Critic is effectively canceled. This will not be his 10th and final feature film. He has completely stepped away from the project and is now back to the drawing board. When it felt like we were so closely moving to the development and the production of this movie, we had heard casting announcements. Tom Cruise was rumored to be in the movie. Upon the cancellation news coming out, apparently Brad Pitt, who we did find out was going to be in the movie, but we did not know that he was going to be coming back, apparently as Cliff Booth, which is a character he portrayed in Once Upon a Time in Hollywood, the most recent movie that they worked on together. But apparently that was going to be a big element to this film, but no more. That is not happening. Quentin is going back to the drawing board. I am very hurt by this. This is devastating to me because who knows how much longer we're going to have to wait now to, you know, just start from scratch and to, you know, maybe wait, I don't know, 3, 4, 5 more years. It's crazy because they were going to go into production on this. It looks like next year, maybe for a late 2025 or an early 2026 release. But now that this is not going to be Quentin's final movie, how do you feel about it? How do you feel about the prospect of not ever seeing this come to fruition? And what do you think about the longer wait that I think we're going to have to endure until we see Quentin Tarantino's next film?
Man, I was excited about this, and so I am pretty sad about it. Just hearing about the Movie Critic, all the news surrounding it, who was going to be in it. I was getting pretty hyped up for this movie, man. I just love Quentin Tarantino, and of course, he made so many movies before I was like actually able to always go to the theater like we do now. And so anytime Quentin Tarantino's on the board, I'm like, let's go. Like, I'm ready to finally, you know, see some Quentin Tarantino in theaters, man. And so I was hoping this was also around the corner. I think the only thing that can like retcon this is Kill Bill 3. Bill 3 is coming and I will be okay, I promise. But until then, man, I am just sad that, like, again, not only the Movie Critic isn't the movie he's going with, but like, again, how long it's going to take us to get to the next project. Like going back to the drawing board can be exhausting, you know what I mean? Especially when you really like a director. It's like, are you serious? Like, this is what we're doing. So it kind of sucks, but what are we going to do?
That's really the thing for me, because it's already been the longest gap between movies. He's never gone this long without making a movie. It's already been 5 years since Once Upon a Time in Hollywood. And to be honest, a part of me wishes like if you were going to make a final movie, that was probably as perfect of a final movie that you could have made. Like, I think that movie's an undeniable masterpiece. It might very well be his best film. It's really a summation of everything that he's about as a filmmaker. And I don't deny that he can still make another masterpiece, another classic. I think every film that he's made is damn near perfect. But it's the wait. It's going to take a long time to just go back to the drawing board and put something together from scratch. We know he's a perfectionist. He's an excellent writer, you know, so he definitely writes his scripts and brings those things to life. And it's just going to be a while. But it should be worth it. I think ultimately, though, this idea of doing 10 films and retiring, it's peculiar. It's a bit of a flawed thing. Like, his whole shtick and idea when he first started having these conversations was that, you know, how many filmmakers do we know who get into their late years, their twilight years, and they're still making great movies? Their final four or five movies are great. It definitely doesn't age well. The other two people we're about to talk about are clear-cut examples of, yes, man, you can still make wonderful movies in your 60s, 70s, and 80s. Like, you can reach new highs. Like, that is very much possible. And so I don't know if we've really talked about this on the pod. I mean, what are your thoughts on just that idea of, like, leaving at 10? Like, I get wanting to have, like, a perfect filmography, and 10 is a nice round number, but are we really going to be robbed of getting Quentin Tarantino movies when he grows older and becomes a wiser man and he gets more life experience into the 70s and the 80s?
Yeah, I do think we'd be robbed. Just again, seeing the great examples from other directors that show us that you can put out some fire no matter how old you get. We talked about at length Martin Scorsese and Hayao Miyazaki, particularly in the last year. It was like, these dudes don't have to be out here doing this. You know what I'm saying? But they choose to do so because they love to do it. And I think from a Quentin Tarantino standpoint, he didn't want, I think, that filmography to be tarnished. But at the same time, I'm curious if he's asking himself, how much do I love to do this thing? Can I actually not make movies and be a happy person without doing that for the rest of my life? And if he says, yeah, I'll be happy with doing that, then fine. But part of me is like, nah, bro, like, there's just no way. Like, you've made some of the craziest movies we've seen. I just can't see him being away. He'll be 10 years into retirement and have an idea. Now what you gonna do? Now you trapped. Now what you gonna do? 11th movie coming out. You know what I'm saying? Like, it has to come. And so I think I understand the timing from when he said it, but again, it just hasn't aged well. That hasn't aged well.
Yeah, in 2012, it probably made sense. I mean, you can look at a lot of examples of, you know, directors who weren't making their best work in those years. But since then, I don't know, maybe Scorsese and Spielberg and Miyazaki, Cronenberg, Ridley Scott, they probably all heard that, and they were like, really? They're like, really? Is that how you feel? We're going to show you. And look at them now. I mean, they're doing so much great, great work. I mean, I cannot imagine not getting The Irishman and Killers of the Flower Moon. I can't imagine not getting West Side Story and The Fablemans. I can't imagine not getting Boy and the Heron. Like, there's really, really good movies there. So I think I'm in disbelief about it. I don't truly believe he's going to just quit. I think
he finna Jay-Z it, bro.
He has to. He really just has to. Because as a writer, he's never going to stop writing. And if he writes a really compelling idea that just feels like it's worthwhile, he'll want to make that movie as well. He's not going to let somebody else take that film from him. He's not going to sell it. I think he'll want to make it himself. And so I don't think that this will last. But we will certainly have to wait for his next feature film whenever that may come. But speaking of one of the greats, Martin Scorsese, man, this guy is in his 80s, like 81, and has already planned out his next two movies. So he is actively at work. He's not slowing down anytime soon. He said, like, after Killers of the Flower Moon, that he probably had three left in him. Well, if that's the case, we know of two of them. Sources now say that he's planning to shoot his next two films back to back. The first one's going to be about Jesus Christ, which is a reoccurring thing for him. This will be probably his third film about Jesus. He did The Last Temptation of Christ with Willem Dafoe. He also did another religious themed movie a few years ago called Silence. Really, really great, tremendous film. And then after he does that movie, he's planning to do a biopic about Frank Sinatra, obviously one of the most iconic and celebrated musicians in all of history, really one of the most celebrated pop culture figures in all of history. And we do know a little bit about these two movies. For The Life of Jesus, which is the first film that he's planning to do, he's looking to independently finance it and bypass the studio system, which he's done for, you know, his past couple of films. He had to pretty much work with streamers for the most part, Apple TV Plus for Killers, Netflix for The Irishman. This one's going to be independently financed. And he's eyeing Andrew Garfield and Miles Teller to be a part of this movie. We don't know the roles that they're going to play, but apparently he's looking to work with them. And then for the Frank Sinatra biopic, he's looking to once again work with frequent longtime collaborator Leonardo DiCaprio, who is slated to play Frank Sinatra. And also Jennifer Lawrence is in talks to play the second wife of Frank Sinatra, Ava Gardner. He was married like four times. He got married a lot. And so this would be the second wife in the marriage that she would portray. So how do you feel about Martin Scorsese? You're still working, not taking any rest, not taking any breaks. And how do you feel individually about these projects and what they might entail?
Man, shout out to Martin Scorsese. Still kicking. Shout out to him and his niece, right? On TikTok. It's him and his niece.
His daughter.
Right? His daughter. That's it. Sorry. Yeah. His daughter. Yeah, no. They're still enjoyable. They're great. Because we don't always get to see, you know, how much life some of these people have, you know what I mean? So it's like, it makes sense that he's making two more movies to me after watching them videos. It's like, yeah, no, he's fine. Life of Jesus is interesting. Like you said, he's done Jesus a couple other times, but I'm really interested in Andrew Garfield and Miles Teller being on screen at the same time. I think they're two very, very talented actors. And one of the critiques I've heard recently, just about Martin Scorsese in general, but it might have actually came after Killers of the Flower Moon, was like, what was Martin Scorsese look like with younger actors? Because all of his actors are just getting older, you know. So I'm really curious what that would look like with the younger guys and Andrew and Miles. Frank Sinatra movie, I mean, Leo can do anything, so I guess, like, in my mind, if somebody's casting Frank Sinatra, I'm like, go get Leo. I probably wouldn't say that, but like, duh, go get Leo. You're Martin Scorsese and Leo. It makes sense. I think That'll be a cool movie too. But yeah, man, Martin Scorsese, not surprised. I'm glad he's still kicking. I can't wait to see both of these. I think they both have potential to be great.
Yeah, to the younger actor's point, I mean, he's Silence has Andrew Garfield.
Andrew Garfield's in that too. Yeah.
And why am I blanking on his name? Kylo Ren from Star Wars.
Driver.
Mm-hmm. Adam Driver, yeah. Those are, I mean, he's done that. Wolf of Wall Street, yeah, a lot of young actors. But, you know, I think Andrew Garfield and Miles Teller, to your point, them being on screen together, I'm very interested in, just because not only are they two of the most talented actors, I think that they're still both grossly underrated. Like, both of them
absolutely
don't get enough praise as they should, because they are just... So good. They're pretty much amazing in most of the things that they do, if not all the things that they do. So... Martin Scorsese, he's been dealing with themes of Catholicism for his entire career. So it's always nice to see a director continue certain threads. You know, mm-hmm. obviously most people know him for the gangster movie or for the machismo, you know, male driven movie. But he's also dealt a lot with Catholicism and has knocked it out of the park, I think, both times, especially with Silence a few years ago. And Frank Sinatra, that's going to be a pretty big undertaking just because of just that's the life he lived. There's so much to cover. I mean, obviously the music and the movies and his personal life with all of his marriages, the potential mob connections. I mean, he's very much a lot of ties with the mafia, you know, that he had. I'm interested to see like what era, if it's going with Ava Gardner, that's around the 50s, which is somewhat of an older Frank Sinatra, not that much older, but a little bit of an older Frank Sinatra. So I don't know if it's going to really encapsulate his entire life as opposed to focusing on a specific time period. But that feels like where they're going to go, kind of focus on a very specific era of his life, especially with Leo, you know, sort of being close to his 50s at this point. That would probably make sense. But sign me up for both. I'm totally here. He's, you know, pretty much, I think, the greatest ever for me personally. And so anything that he does, especially now, knowing the streak that he's on, I think that these both are very, very exciting prospects. So I can't wait to see what comes from them. And lastly, in terms of our director talk, Steven Spielberg, another GOAT. It looks like his next movie is planned out, and it's likely going to be a UFO film, which, again, very similar theme to what he's been tackling for his entire career. Close Encounters, E.T., the man knows extraterrestrial life. He knows how to do stuff about aliens, even War of the Worlds. That movie fucking rips with Tom Cruise. Love that.
I love that movie.
It's great. We don't talk about that movie enough.
We don't. I agree. It's
really incredible. And also David Koepp is going to write the screenplay apparently for this next film. So don't really know much more than that. But I think, again, when you have this idea, a UFO film, an extraterrestrial film, and you pair it with the director, Steven Spielberg, who practically made that particular genre famous and what it is in the modern context, you really can't go wrong. So I'm excited about this.
Yeah, he seen Nope and was like, you know what? Let's spin the block. No, I love this, man. Just Steven Spielberg, again, we talked about him potentially, you know, it'd be cool if he directed a Superman film. But I just wanted Steven Spielberg to give me that sense of wonder again. I think Superman could have done that for sure. But saying it's a UFO movie, sign me up. I mean, you said it all. Give me Third Encounters, but like 2025, whenever this movie comes out, 2026. You know what I mean? Update it, scale it, make it cool. I'm really excited to see what this could be. And it's crazy because I don't know, for some reason, not that I thought that he would retire, but after The Fablemans, I was like, huh, I wonder what he's going to do next. I just didn't think it would be like, I'm going to do a UFO movie. For some reason, that's not what I had in my mind, but I am so down for it. So yeah, man, I'm pretty excited for this actually.
Yeah, you know, and it's never, even with those, you know, films like E.T. and Close Encounter, like it's never just about the aliens. Like his movies are about families and parents, you know, and that's been his bag, about parenthood and about, you know, broken families to a certain extent. So I imagine that this movie, of course, will have the backdrop of UFOs and aliens, but there's going to be a family central story there at play.
For sure.
Can't wait to see who's cast, who's going to be a part of it. Is he going to work with some frequent collaborators? Is he going to work with some people new? Typically, he likes to discover people and work with new people. So I'm curious to see who jumps on board for this next film. But all three of these directors, I mean, look, we live in a wonderful time where we can still talk about them having work and coming out with work. These are three of my favorite filmmakers ever. So can't wait to see what's all down the pipeline for them. And in our last news item that we're going to cover this week, it's a new trailer that just came out for Transformers 1, which will be dropping this fall. It's coming out this September from Paramount Pictures. This is an animated Transformers movie, which we've not gotten in a really long time, especially in the theatrical context. Not since the 80s, technically. They've done a lot of animated shows and things of that nature, but to have a big movie come out in theaters, it's been a long while since we've gotten that from the Transformers franchise, because they've really just dove into live action for the past 15 years with the Michael Bay movies and then recently with Rise of the Beasts. But now we finally got our first look at Transformers 1 and what that's going to entail. And it's an origin story. It's basically an origin story of the Transformers, and particularly of Optimus Prime. Makes a lot of sense, especially considering the title. Has a really great voice cast behind it. Chris Hemsworth is in the movie, Brian Tyree Henry, a lot of other people. So definitely it's going to be a big, big movie of the fall. What did you think about just this first trailer and this first look at Transformers 1?
Man, I think it looks fine. You know, what's so interesting about that live action Transformers franchise, after a while, it's like they knew they had the CGI right. Like, regardless of how terrible those movies are, they always usually look good. Yeah. And it's like, it's almost like after they figured that part out, they was like, we don't need a story. Skip the story. And so now I feel like Transformers 1 is forcing them to get back to the story. Cause now it's not just about 100% the animation. It's like, no, you have to make a good animated movie. Like, the story cannot be bad in animated movies. Like, and people will just not go watch it. And so I think they're doing something here, man. I'm excited to see how it pans out, but I think it looks fine. I think it's a welcome change to the Transformers franchise, and hopefully they give us some good stuff. The cast looks good. The story looks like something, even though it is going back to the early days. It looks refreshing. It looks like it'll be funny. Of course, they're hiding some cool visual things too. I know the battles are finna be insane, so I'm pretty on board with this, man. It looks good to me.
And how did you feel about the animation style? Because I was really curious about that. It's not the traditional hand-drawn animation that they used to do. Things have changed. Obviously, CG animation has taken over. I saw a couple of critiques, which they just kind of felt unrealistic. Like, I saw somebody say, like, oh, I thought that this movie was going to be animated like the first 10 minutes of Bumblebee was, which was, I mean, if you see Bumblebee in the first 10 minutes, like, that's complete CG animation. And if they did that, it would be the most expensive movie ever made. Like, That's animation within a live action context. You know, this is like a pure animated movie. But what did you think just about the animation style and how things look?
I liked it, man. It actually felt like if they decided to make a Transformers cartoon and put it on Netflix, I think this is what it would look like. you know what I mean? Like, I'm like, yeah, this is exactly what that would look like. And so I'm fine with it. I think the 3D-ness makes sense for what Transformers can be. As well, I think 2D also would have been welcome, like, of course, but I think if they do this right, the animation is fine. I think it'll be really cool. They can do some different things that they wouldn't otherwise be able to do in kind of that 2D realm.
Yeah, I'm very much looking forward to this. It makes you wonder, like, damn, why haven't they been doing these for like years? But they prioritize the live action movies, which makes sense. You know, for a long time, those were making boatloads of money. Hella money for whatever reason. But now that that's changed, they've had to go back to the drawing board, get more creative, focus more on story and character.
Exactly.
Which, you know, Transformers has always been really great with its characters. It's not like it's bad source material. Like, Optimus Prime, Megatron, like, all of these are like very, very well written and developed characters. And so I'm very excited to get back to that, to just get to the essence of what Transformers is, and to do it in this way in animation, when we're sort of in this somewhat of a renaissance altogether for the industry. You know, things are just happening, and the game has changed drastically with Spider-Verse and Ninja Turtles and Mitchell's and the Machines. Like, there's just so much great competition out there. I'm curious to see how this fits in with that narrative that's been developing over the past few years, because it's a very, very competitive landscape, but it's also a great landscape that can still produce a lot of ingenuity and originality. And hopefully this Transformers 1 film will achieve that come this fall. But we will certainly have to see. But folks, with all of that said, that's all we have for this episode of Two Black Nerds. Thank you again, as always, for tuning into another podcast. If you've not checked out our reviews of X-Men 97, definitely go listen to those. We've been reviewing that series each and every week. You should definitely be watching that on Disney Plus. It's an amazing show. We talk about each and every episode, so go look at that in the feed. And we will, of course, be back next week, because we have to talk about the new Zendaya film, Challengers, which is going to drop this upcoming weekend, so we will be back to talk about that. And also, Shogun is wrapping up on Hulu, so we're going to have to definitely provide our thoughts on that incredible, amazing series that's airing right now on Hulu. The season finale will be coming out this week, and so we'll be back to share our thoughts and reactions to Shogun next week. So plenty to look forward to, but until then, we will see y'all next time.
Yes, sir. We are Audi 5000. Please check out our Nerds of Mischief collection at twoblacknerds.com. And remember, always bet on black. Appreciate y'all. Love y'all. Thank you for listening to another episode of Two Black Nerds, where we're too black,
too nerdy.
And we out, y'all. Peace. My eyes are wrong, but things want beauty is a symptom of